We're talking about new developments in HIV/AIDS research here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Researchers announced this month that for the second time in history, a man has been cured of HIV. Is this a breakthrough? About 1.1 million Americans have the virus, and about 1 million people are in danger of getting it. Is HIV an issue in your community? How does it affect you and your loved ones? We're at 800-642-1234. David O'Connor is a pathology and laboratory medicine professor at the UW-Madison. His lab looks at viral infections impacting human health, and he's on a year-long sabbatical at the Peter Doherty Institute for Infection and Immunity in Melbourne, Australia. Dave, welcome to the Ideas Network. Are you there, Dave? Dave, can you hear us? We're having a little bit of technical difficulties as we look at HIV/AIDS and the developments on the horizon. About 1.1 million Americans have the virus, and about 1 million people are in danger of giving it. Dave, are you there? We still can't hear Dave as we take a look at HIV and AIDS. And we're trying to get him who he is in Melbourne, Australia. He heads the O'Connor Lab at the university, which looks at viral infections that impact human health. Are you living with HIV? What is life like for you in your treatments? Maybe you don't have HIV, but you're taking a preventative medication to avoid it. Why did you decide to do that? We're at 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas at WPR.org. You can tweet us at WPR Mornings. And so what are your thoughts on the new cure that we have seen this month come out, the London patient? You can join in at 800-642-1234. Dave, are you with us? Can you hear us, Dave? I don't think we quite have Dave yet, and I think we're trying to get him on the phone here. We are talking about HIV/AIDS here on The Morning Show and looking for your insights. Are you living with HIV? What has your treatment protocol been like? And what about the cost of treatments, the access? Join in at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. When you learned about the London patient and a cure, did you find hope in this? Are you concerned about the future of HIV/AIDS and the impact it has here in the U.S. and around the world? You can join in at 800-642-1234. I think we're getting Dave O'Connor here on the phone. He is a pathology and laboratory medicine professor at UW-Madison. Dave, are you there?
I am.
Great. Sorry about that, unable to get you there. But first of all, can you help us understand HIV is a virus and AIDS is a condition caused by HIV. Can you help us understand the difference a little bit better, the interconnectedness there?
Sure. So if you go back to the 1980s, these two terms were often used interchangeably after we discovered that the HIV virus led to the development of AIDS, this condition where the immune system breaks down. The HIV virus infects and destroys T cells, which is a type of cell in the immune system that's important for quarterbacking the immune response to other types of pathogens or things that could make us sick. And over the last 20 years, we've come up with really good treatments that suppress the ability of the virus to infect these cells, and when you suppress the ability of the virus to infect cells, you get healthier. And so fortunately, today, there's about 20 million people around the world who are receiving effective treatment for HIV, and these people will typically have a normal life expectancy and will never develop AIDS.
We're going to get into the treatment protocols in a moment, but how do you get HIV and how common is it?
Well, in the state of Wisconsin, about 75% of new HIV infections are among men who have sex with men. Injecting drug users are another population in Wisconsin who are a focus for prevention efforts. So it's important to note that in a state like Wisconsin, we're actually on the low end of new HIV cases, with only about 250 new cases each year.
So is it improving as you look at the trend lines on the number of cases here in Wisconsin and across the U.S.?
Well, the number of cases has remained stubborn and about the same over the last decade. But what has dramatically changed is the outcomes for people who find out that they're HIV positive. The drug treatments today are heaps better than they were even 5 or 10 years ago. They're easier to take, and people enjoy much better, longer, healthier lives than they used to.
Last week, it was announced that a man has been in remission from HIV for a year and a half, and he wants to remain anonymous, so researchers are calling him the London patient. What do we know about this case?
Sure. So about 20 years ago, researchers discovered that there is a special type of protein on the surface of cells called CCR5, and this is sort of a lock that the virus needs to pick to infect most cells. And people who lack this CCR5 protein really can't get infected with HIV. And there's a small number of people who naturally lack this CCR5 protein. So about 10 years ago, researchers who needed to perform a bone marrow transplant on someone who had both HIV and a life-threatening form of cancer did a bone marrow transplant on someone, Timothy Ray Brown, who used to be known as the Berlin patient, but they did something quite clever. They used cells that from a donor who was naturally lacking these CCR5 proteins. And after the bone marrow transplant took, the Timothy Ray Brown's immune system was now repopulated with these cells that lacked this protein, and the virus didn't have anywhere to go. And he was the first case of someone who had gone into long-term HIV remission. And then last week, it was announced that a similar sort of transplant, again in someone who had cancer and HIV, again with a donor who was lacking this protein on the surface of their cells, the CCR5 protein, had a similar sort of outcome where after the bone marrow transplant, his cancer went into remission. Then he interrupted his HIV treatment, and the HIV seemed to be in remission too. These are unusual cases.
These are unusual cases. And should we be calling these cases a cure? I mean, a bone marrow transplant is pretty extreme, and it wouldn't be perhaps a normal treatment protocol.
Oh, not at all. So this is really not generally applicable to most people who have HIV who are treated with drugs that are now quite good. This is really a very specialized case where you have someone who has both a life-threatening cancer and HIV and who really needs a bone marrow transplant to have the opportunity to potentially survive the cancer that they have. Even in places that are world-renowned for doing these bone marrow transplants, like Memorial Sloan Kettering, there's only about a 75% of people who get these transplants survive for more than 1 year.
We're talking about what needs to be done to end the HIV/AIDS epidemic and to cures that have attracted attention. David O'Connor is a professor of pathology and laboratory medicine at UW-Madison. You have a line at 800-642-1234. Are you living with HIV? Let's talk about it. We'll pick up the conversation in a minute on the Ideas Network. We're talking about how to end the HIV/AIDS epidemic. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. President Trump's 2020 budget seeks an extra $291 million to stop the spread of HIV. The president announced his goal in the State of the Union last month.
My budget will ask Democrats and Republicans to make the needed commitment to eliminate the HIV epidemic in the United States within 10 years. We have made incredible strides, incredible.
A big part of the White House strategy is getting people into treatment quickly. We're looking at breakthroughs and how to control the spread of HIV. How does HIV affect you or a loved one? What are the biggest barriers to care? Is it cost or access? Where do you hope to see HIV research in the next several years? Join in at 800-642-1234. UW-Madison pathologist Dave O'Connor stays with us, and his lab focuses on viral infections in humans. So, Dave, aside from the two patients who are said to be cured, and we looked at that treatment, how effective are we currently when treating HIV?
Well, the treatments are now very good. Most people in the U.S. can take one pill once a day and can expect to have a relatively normal life expectancy with fairly few side effects. In fact, the same drugs that most people take to treat HIV can also be taken by people who are at high risk of becoming infected to prevent themselves from getting HIV in much the same way as a woman would take a hormonal birth control pill.
But we've also, as we've seen these strides, there have been cost issues. There is this once-a-day pill, but it sells for more than $1,600 a month, and until recently wasn't covered by insurance companies. What do we know there?
Well, in terms of using it as a prevention, there's a variety of ways that people can access it. It is now covered through Badger Care Plus. Patients who have private insurance can get it through private insurance, and the companies that make these drugs also have access programs for those who neither have private insurance and don't qualify for federal support.
Let's take a call now. Let's go to Marcus joining us from Milwaukee. Good morning, Marcus. Are you there, Marcus? We're seeming to have trouble here getting Marcus. What else do we know? Who is most at risk of contracting HIV? What do we know about college students and other at-risk populations?
Well, again, in the state of Wisconsin, the 75% of infections are new infections are occurring in men who have sex with men. And within this population, ethnic minorities are at particular risk. So more than 60% of new infections in Wisconsin are among racial and ethnic minorities, even though these populations comprise less than 20% of Wisconsin's population.
So let's say a father and a mother both have HIV, but they're taking medication for it. They conceive, give birth to a child that is HIV-free. How likely is that scenario to take place today?
Well, fortunately, there's been great strides at preventing the transmission of HIV during birth and after birth. Women can now take antiretroviral drugs or these HIV drugs while they're pregnant and while they're breastfeeding, or they could opt to use formula feeding, so that the transmission of HIV to babies in the U.S. Is really rare right now, though this is still a major route of transmission worldwide in places where some of these advances aren't as widely available as they are here.
Let's try Marcus again in Milwaukee. Marcus, are you there?
Good morning, Kate.
Good morning. What's on your mind?
So my question for David is, I've heard that European population has 10% approximate natural immunity to HIV/AIDS, and I was just wondering if you could possibly give me some reasons as to the what's the cause and effect there.
Are there immunities?
Yeah. So again, there is a small fraction of Northern Europeans who don't have this LOC protein, the CCR5 protein, on the surface of their cells, and people who naturally don't have this protein seem to be otherwise healthy, but they are resistant to acquiring HIV, especially if they get if they don't have a copy of this protein on the DNA that they get from both of their parents. People who are what we call homozygous or who don't have any of the CCR5 protein are very, very rarely infected with HIV. Though there are some types of HIV that can bypass this particular CCR5 protein and use other proteins to get access to cells. So it's not a perfect resistance, but if you have this, your risk of getting HIV is dramatically reduced.
Can researchers take anything from this very small population and apply it in their research labs to make it more universal among other people?
Yeah, there's lots of work trying to do that at UW-Madison and elsewhere, engineering stem cells that lack these proteins and then coming up with ways that they can be delivered to mimic the sort of effect that we see in the Berlin and London patients without the potential toxicity of a bone marrow transplant.
Yeah, and taking the cases of the Berlin and London patients, so what do HIV/AIDS researchers do next to end this epidemic and figure out how to, as President Trump would say, have an end to all cases but in the next decade?
Well, I think that these cases shouldn't be confused with the strides that are going to end the epidemic. So we have a toolkit that we can now use to prevent and treat HIV, and this involves medical circumcision of men, which reduces men's risk of getting HIV by more than 50%. If people are successfully treated with these antiretroviral drugs, they are not going to transmit the virus to their partners. For some people where they're at high risk, taking these drugs prophylactically or like birth control pills will reduce their risk of becoming infected. You put all of these things together with the old-fashioned tools that we've known about for a long time, wearing condoms correctly and reliably, being careful about your partners and being educated about how HIV is transmitted. And, you know, you put all these things together and you can see a path that's going to lead to no infections at some point in the future. So, for example, in the UK, the number of men who have sex with men who are getting HIV has, you know, plummeted by more than 50% in 1 year by adopting all of these different technologies, you know, as they are appropriate for individual people and their individual circumstances.
And perhaps public health and getting the word out about how to stop the spread is one of the big things in trying to find an end to this?
Yeah, that's a great point. So there's always been a big stigma around HIV, and that has led a lot of people who are at risk to not seek out medical care if they're at risk or if they think they might be infected. But I would urge anyone who thinks that they may have had risky exposures that could lead to HIV to go in and get tested, because if you get tested and if you have HIV, the treatments now will give you a normal life expectancy. Those same treatments will prevent you from transmitting the virus to your partners. And the sooner you get on treatment after you're infected, the better your prognosis is going to be. The longer you're going to be able to live, the healthier you're going to remain. And so there really is a need to push early diagnosis and early treatment.
Do you find that there, and this is outside the realm of research, but do you still see the stigma and discrimination in HIV?
It's certainly there. I think it varies based on where you are. There's a lot of people now who don't feel like they know anyone who has HIV, and certainly you don't see as much of a vivid epidemic as we did before the drugs were widely available. And as you mentioned at the start, I'm in Melbourne, Australia for the year. And here you see advertisements on the streets, you see on the front doors of pharmacies, stickers that say PrEP is here. PrEP is the name for this pre-exposure prophylaxis, where you take HIV drugs as birth control. And here you see advertisements where they say, you know, if you're at risk, come in and let's learn a little bit more about it and see if it's right for you. And I think that that speaks to how the stigma has been reduced, at least in some places, over the years.
Dave, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
David O'Connor is a professor of pathology and laboratory medicine at UW-Madison, and his lab looks at viral infections that impact human health. We caught up with him on sabbatical at the Peter Doherty Institute for Infection and Immunity in Melbourne, Australia. Coming up, we head to the 6th Annual Summit for Young Black Men in Milwaukee. News is next. Stay with us on the Ideas Network. We're talking about the Summit on Black Male Youth here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. More than 1,000 young men plan to attend this 6th annual summit put on by the UW-Milwaukee. Black men, what challenges did you face growing up in Wisconsin or in the Midwest? What support did you need or get? You can share your story at 800-642-1234. Tweet us, WPR Mornings. We have two organizers of this two-day summit with us. Gary Williams is an associate professor of educational policy and community studies, and he's also director of the Institute for Intercultural Research at UW-Milwaukee. Gary, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Well, thank you very much for having me this morning. I appreciate it.
And we also have your colleague, Jim Hill, the Associate Vice Chancellor of the Office of Student Life and Student Affairs at UW-Milwaukee. Jim, welcome to you.
Thank you very much, and good morning, and thanks for having me as well.
Well, Jim, let's get started with you. How did this summit begin?
Actually, when Dr. Williams hosted a listening session at UW-Milwaukee, he had several UWM faculty and staff kind of help facilitate a conversation where he invited organizations in the community to bring black males to campus. We just kind of wanted to hear what some of the challenges were that they were facing and what some of their needs were. And out of that listening session came some powerful feedback from those young men about what they needed and some of their challenges. And following that listening session, a group of faculty and staff, we just talked about it and thought, okay, we need to continue this conversation and we need to bring these young men together. And so that planted the seed for the planning of the summit.
And Gary, it sounds like you've really brought a number of youth together here. How broad is the reach of this summit?
Oh, the reach is in southeastern Wisconsin and northern Illinois. In past summits, we've invited and worked with students from Dane County, for example, obviously Milwaukee County, but also Kenosha, Racine, and Lake County, northern Illinois, Wheaton, Illinois school district students have been a part of this in the past.
And this year's theme, Gary, is Black Boys Thriving, Reimagining the Narrative. What challenges are part of a daily experience for Black boys and youth and the narratives they have to deal with?
Well, the narrative is one they do live with on a daily basis. They see it in their communities, in their homes, and on the television, the media, and that. And it's a narrative that we are in the process of changing. We want to change the trajectory for these Black male youth by exposing them to options and opportunities beyond those they see in their immediate community and in their schools and homes.
We often say flip the narrative. Jim, I'm wondering, do you see this happening at all?
Excuse me?
Yeah, we often say when we're talking about the narrative or what Black youth are experiencing and we want to flip the narrative, do you see changes for these young men in their communities where they live?
Yeah, they can have, and that's one of the things we want to stress with them is that they can have a positive future with different options, that what they see doesn't have to define them, that they can explore other opportunities and look beyond their communities and look beyond the challenges that they face every day. So that's part of the flipping the narrative, so that, that they can see that, that, yes, I have options and I can explore other alternatives to my life and I can be successful. We don't necessarily define what success looks like for them. We want them to reach that on their own, but we want them to realize that, that success could be for them graduating from high school, going into the military, and then exploring other options after that, or graduating from high school and getting to the skilled trades, graduating from high school and going into the military. I mean, to work in law enforcement or emergency management. I mean, those kinds of options we want to make sure that they see that they have.
We're talking with Jim Hill and Gary Williams of UW-Milwaukee about the next week's sixth annual summit on Black male youth. And you can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Young men, are you attending this summit in Milwaukee next week? What are you looking forward to? What conversations do you hope to have? And what about you teachers and administrators in southern Wisconsin? What are you looking forward to for your students who are attending? You can call in at 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Gary, in the past, you've been, or actually, Jim, in the past, you've been quoted as saying that this event is to offer another pipeline to young Black men, in a reference to the school-to-prison pipeline. In the time since the summit has happened, what have you seen it offer for young men?
I've seen it offer them the opportunity to explore things that that they may not have thought that they could accomplish. We've had some follow-up workshops after the summit, and some young men have returned to the UWM campus for a presentation from skilled tradesmen. They've returned to the campus for presentations or exploring the STEM field. They've come back to the campus to look at health administration or working in the health field. So it opens doors to them because at the summit they will be having workshops on around academic success and health and wellness issues, life skills, and life after high school. So those are the things we want them to experience when they're at the summit. And then hopefully after that, we can get them involved in some follow-up activities that will help create a different pipeline for them.
Gary, what do you want to convey to this really captive audience of young Black men at this summit? What do you hope that they walk away with?
Well, as Jim said, options and opportunities. We want to share with them different paths towards success, however they define success in their lives. As Jim says, whether that's after high school, you're looking at the military, going into a post-secondary institution to have that experience, but also the skilled trades are available to you following high school. You know, and something you said, and Jim mentioned this as well, this school-to-prison pipeline that we hear about, that pipeline now begins at preschool for many of these young Black males. And one of the things we hope to do is derail that train toward prison that goes from preschool to school to elementary, middle, and beyond. The research is very clear about this, Kate. If we are able to derail that train toward prison in the middle school, high school and post-secondary are much easier and less complicated and more realistic for these young men.
Oh, what you're saying, the younger that we can get at these youth, the younger that we can start making the impressions, the better the chances they have.
Absolutely. And the research bears this out. Again, one of the things that we're proud of is we expose these boys to positive, caring, and supportive Black males that they see around them, and we listen to the voice of the boys. That's critically important, and that's where we began this in 2012. is listening to the voices of these boys and then providing them with knowledge, information they need. So again, we derail that train toward prison that we hear so much about.
And this summit is an effort of the UW-Milwaukee African American Male Initiative. Jim, what is that initiative? What is that organization?
Well, basically, it's an organization of African American faculty and staff at UWM. As I mentioned, in 2012, when we had that first listening session, a few of us afterwards started talking about, okay, what can we do to kind of help, address the success of the African-American males that were on our campus, because, again, many of them were struggling to be retained and graduated from the institution. So we wanted to find ways to address that issue. But then we realized that we needed to get at these young men in middle school and high school so that if they make a decision to come to higher education, they're better prepared. Because in high school, the junior and senior year, if they haven't laid a solid academic foundation, they're going to struggle when they come into the college environment. So we saw that and realized that. So we wanted to put this in place so that those young men who decided to go to college, and it's not necessarily about UWM, because we have individuals at the table that are from MHEC, Milwaukee, and as well as Marquette. So again, we have partnered with others in the community that see the same challenges and want to try to address the issues for the young men that they see coming to their campuses.
Let's bring in Carol now, joining us from Milwaukee. Carol, hi, what's your experience?
Good morning. I'm calling, and I'm a counselor in a Milwaukee charter high school. I spend a lot of my time working with students to plan their future. In fact, our school has a program where students can take all of their senior year classes at MAPC. In the past, I've brought students to the Black Male Summit, which I think is really important. I've also heard about the program at UWM to support Black male students, but I've had trouble getting information and connecting with people about this. I'd like to get in the email chain or whatever,
sure,
so that I get information.
Well, Carol, thank you so much for your call. And we're going to get an answer on the other side of this break. We're talking about the 6th Annual Summit on Black Male Youth that will be held Monday and Tuesday at UW-Milwaukee. Gary Williams and Jim Hill, both of UW-Milwaukee, stay with us as we explore the needs and successes of young Black men in our communities. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Call in, email ideas at WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation in a minute on the Ideas Network. We're talking about a Black Youth Summit next week in Milwaukee. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The two-day summit will bring together middle school and high school boys from dozens of schools around Milwaukee. The talks will focus on the range of opportunities and options that are out there for men of color who have faced adversity. Let's hear from educators and administrators. Are you planning to go to this summit, or have you attended in the past? What do you hope to learn, and what are you and your students bringing to the table? We're at 800-642-1234. We're talking with Gary Williams and Jim Hill of UW-Milwaukee, who are part of the large number of groups and stakeholders putting on this 6th annual summit together. Gary, I want to go back to you with Carol, who had said she's having difficulty getting connected to this summit. How do you reach out to schools and maintain those relationships?
Well, over the years, we've developed a pretty lengthy email or contact information on these schools. The ones that have participated in the past register their students as well as their teachers and chaperones who accompany them. So our initial reach is usually to the folks who've attended in the past, and we ask that they share that information with others. So we try as best we can to get the word out each year early enough to give the school districts an opportunity to make arrangements, meaning students have to get permission slips. School districts have to order transportation and that. So we try to reach out as broadly and as quickly as possible to as many schools, not only in Milwaukee County, as I said, but in Dane County, as well as Northern Illinois, Cook and Lake County, Racine, Kenosha counties as well.
Jim, how many kids are you expecting this year? And did you expect this to grow like it has?
We're expecting somewhere around 1,000 middle schools on Monday and somewhere around 800-900 high schoolers on Tuesday. No, we did not expect it to grow as fast. That's one of the reasons why typically this is the first time we are doing this in March. Typically, we had done it in December, and we had reached capacity for the space that was available to us in December. And so by moving it to March, when our students are on spring break at UWM, we have the capacity to then expand into other buildings and spaces so that we could accommodate more young men. So we're hoping that will happen this year by allowing us to be able to expand and add additional space on campus to serve them.
Jim, you have so many students coming. I'm wondering, can you still have those heart-to-heart conversations? Can you still reach individual students?
We hope so. One of the things that we stress to the presenters when they submit the proposals is we're looking for presentations and proposals that will engage the young men. And we try to keep the sessions small as we can. That was something we were running into when we had limited space when we were doing this in December. By expanding it to two other buildings that are attached to our student union, we hope to keep smaller presentation size. And we have recruited more presenters, and we've stressed to them, we want sessions that are engaged young men that they're just not talked to, that they have an opportunity to speak back and so that we can hear them. Because again, as Dr. Williams said, their voice is important to this.
Gary, you're working with two quite distinct groups, middle schoolers and high schoolers. How does the programming vary based on their age and where they're at developmentally?
Yeah, we found over the last few years, Kate, that many of the issues and concerns are similar, whether they're in middle school or high school. They're very similar. In high school, though, obviously the focus is on successfully completing high school and quickly moving on to life after high school, which, as we said at the beginning, may be pathways to a post-secondary institution, a skilled trades area, military. There are other options available to you. With the middle school kids, we're talking about trades, professions, life after high school, but our focus there is looking more at pre-college initiatives. So how do we help you successfully complete middle school so you move into high school? Skill development, looking at social-emotional development and characteristics of that particular population, and also informing them that what they do, the building blocks, foundation that they develop in middle school will increase their success when they move into high school. So it's slightly different, but many of the issues and concerns they bring are very similar.
Many of these young men are first-generation college students. Do you see distinct differences in the needs of a first-generation college student? Gary?
Yeah, absolutely. You have kids, as you say, first-generation, meaning no one in the family has completed a post-secondary, in their immediate family, has completed a post-secondary experience. So there's information out there that they may not be aware of. And so the summit is another opportunity to expose them to this new information, looking at pathways to success, completing high school or completing middle school, completing high school, that these options and opportunities are well within your grasp, as young men. And they take that information back home, Kate, and share it with others there. And sometimes it's an eye-opening experience for the people in their homes and communities to see there are options and opportunities that the boys' strengths will help them achieve.
Jim, as this summit grows larger and larger, surely there's lots more people working on the background and how to put this together. Who helps put this summit together?
We have a planning committee, and it's a planning and work committee. It's about 30 now, maybe almost 40 individuals who care about working with these students' populations. We have individuals there from corporate America, foundations around the city, community-based organizations. As I mentioned earlier, folks from MATC and Marquette. So this is something that we kind of look at all hands on deck to try to address these issues these young men are facing and to support them. Because, again, we're all kind of tired of reading about our young men and when they're in trouble. We want to make sure that basically they know that doesn't have to be their life, that they can have other options. And everyone kind of cares about that. And I think corporate America is around the table because, again, they recognize and realize that this is the potential employees of the future and for Milwaukee, and that they need to be there to support them, to make sure that they are there when it's time to recruit and hire them to their companies.
Jim, is this summit unique, or do you see these types of gatherings around the country?
There's others around the country. The University of Akron sponsors one annually. Some others as well. Some on smaller scales. Some on larger scales. The one at University of Akron is much larger than ours. But again, they've been doing it a few more years than we have. And we're not unique in this. I think it's something that around the country we all see the challenges that our young men are facing, and we all want to try to do something about that.
Gary, what keeps you at night as you try to set these young Black youth on a course for success in their lives?
You know, I try to make certain that we address their issues and concerns when they're with us. As Jim said, we expose these young men by listening to their voices and responding to them. We expose them to those options and opportunities that are available to them. Our hope is that they will take full advantage of it, that now we've introduced them to a reality that may be very different from the reality they live with on a daily basis. Again, that narrative that's out there about them. So the hope is that by listening to their voices, it gives us an opportunity to help to support them and respond to their issues and concerns.
Thank you both for joining us. Gary Williams there, and we also had Jim Hill, both of UW-Milwaukee, and you can find a link to the summit on the Morning Show page at WPR.org.